Director of Airlines and Hotel and Tour Operators fear abrupt changes to coronavirus travel rules by governments are killing their chances to salvage something of a wrecked vacation season. The British government's sudden decision this weekend to add Spain to its list of at-risk countries forced tens of thousands of Britons already holidaying in Spain to quarantine for 14 days on their return. It also upended plans for thousands of others scheduling vacations. Britain isn't alone in opting for caution. This weekend saw Ireland omit Britain from a list of safe countries, telling its citizens it should be avoided for all but essential travel. France has issued a warning about traveling to Spain. Norway, too, is advising against travel to Spain. Almost 40 countries worldwide have reported record single-day increases in coronavirus infections during the past week, and fears of an imminent second wave of the pandemic in Europe are also mounting. Highest number of coronavirus cases are in the U.S., with over 4.1 million cases reported, followed by Brazil with more than 2.3 million, India with over 1.3 million, Russia with over 811,000, and South Africa with more than 434,000 cases reported. French authorities have charged a Rwandan church volunteer who confessed to setting on fire the 15th century Nantes Cathedral. The local prosecutor's office said the 39-year-old asylum seeker, who has lived in France for several years, was detained Saturday for a second time. He had been held for a day, questioned and released immediately after the fire on July 18th. After initially denying it, the prosecution says the suspect admitted being responsible for the fire that started in three different places at the Cathedral of St. Peter and St. Paul. The man's lawyer said his client bitterly regretted his acts. This is VOA News. Staff of the U.S. consulate in Chengdu made final efforts to clear the premises on Sunday, with security remaining tight outside. This comes ahead of a Monday closure ordered by Beijing as China-U.S. relations continue to worsen. China has charged that some personnel at the consulate were conducting activities not in line with their identities. China's order to close the consulate was issued Friday in retaliation for a U.S. order to close the Chinese consulate in Houston, Texas. The closures further escalate the tensions between the two countries over issues ranging from trade and industrial espionage to human rights. The Taliban accused Afghan security forces Sunday of rearresting insurgents who had been released as part of a crucial prisoner swap meant to kickstart peace talks. They said the National Directorate of Security, or NDS, had detained an unspecified number of insurgents released under the exchange program, warning that Kabul would bear responsibility for the consequences. The spokesman for Afghanistan's National Security Council said the claim was incorrect. Prisoner swap has been a major stumbling block in getting Kabul and the Taliban to start peace talks. Under a deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, the Afghan government is supposed to release 5,000 insurgent prisoners, while the Taliban frees 1,000 government inmates. Kabul has released most of the 5,000, but the NDS has said some of the Taliban inmates are returning to the battlefield. The Council of Europe said Sunday it is alarmed by the Polish justice minister's call for his country to withdraw from a landmark international treaty combating violence against women. Poland's justice minister said that Monday he will begin preparing the process to withdraw from the Istanbul Convention. A previous centrist Polish government signed the treaty in 2012, and it was ratified in 2015 when the justice minister called it a feminist creation aimed at justifying gay ideology. The treaty was spearheaded by the Council of Europe, the continent's oldest human rights organization, which emphasized that the treaty's sole objective is to combat violence against women and that it does not explicitly mention gay marriage. But that has not stopped the backlash to it in Hungary and Slovakia as well, where the parliament rejected the treaty, insisting that it is at odds with the country's constitutional definition of marriage as a heterosexual union. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com or download our easy-to-use app to your mobile device. This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, reporting from Washington.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So we believe that it is time that we don't continue to make considerations that will hold the people of Mali back. We need to go forward and we need to seize this moment to make the right decision, but also tough decision for the welfare of the people of Mali.
West African regional leaders plan to meet Monday to help resolve the ongoing political stalemate in Mali.
The president is fully committed. He's already been proclaimed as the champion of anti-corruption in West Africa, in the entire continent of Africa. He will not fail Nigerians. He will not fail Africa.
A presidential spokesperson sharply rejected the resignation demands of Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari by the main opposition, the People's Democratic Party, or PDP.
We work with different organized groups, whether it's civil society organizations, whether it's the urban movement, to make sure that the needs of each and every settlement in a city are taken into account, to make sure that they come to the planning table, to make sure that the programs have really considered the needs of those areas.
And mayors of some African cities launch a recovery plan to address the impact of the coronavirus. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. West African regional leaders are scheduled to meet in an extraordinary summit about the crisis in Mali Monday. The meeting comes after the leaders met in Bamako with government officials and representatives of the opposition coalition M5. The regional leaders of state are expected to come up with recommendations to help ease the political stalemate in the West African country. The opposition coalition is demanding that the president should step down, but officials have rejected those demands, saying they are unacceptable. Yaysa Make is a leading member of the opposition coalition M5 and a former opposition presidential candidate. He tells me that the killing of at least 24 Malians by the police boosts the demands for the president to step down. He adds that the opposition will not accept any other alternative offer from the regional leaders until the president relinquishes power.
Well, first, I think that we appreciate this is a mechanism of the ECOWAS Articles of Incorporation, where if the president of each member state can trigger this mechanism to bring mediation into internal conflict. And this is the third mission of the ECOWAS to Mali, and each of the missions previously have made recommendations which were not followed by the president. And the president is acting as if everything was normal, but we are not in a normal time, and he is heavily contested, and he has failed his people. And when the regional leaders recommended that he dissolve the National Assembly, dissolve the Constitutional Court, and proceed to forming a government with a full-power prime minister, he did not follow and implement those measures. So he thought he can talk his way out of this, and unfortunately, the demand is more pressing, and he does not have any other option. So when the regional presidents came, I think that the method was not what was expected, because things have evolved since the last mission, where the president has killed so many people through the police force and brutally pressuring the protestations. So killing 24 Malian people by the police force. And this really has galvanized the people of Mali, that the president's role is not to kill his own people but solve our problems. Instead, he acted in with brutality. And now the demand is that he steps down.
Is the opposition coalition, for which you are a leading member, still demanding his resignation, which, of course, is still an unconstitutional, as the government argues, because the president just won re-election. Telling him to resign is basically going against the constitution, they argue. What do you say to that?
Absolutely not. Our constitution, the preamble of the constitution said, we, the people of Mali, are sovereign. The sovereignty of the people have only been delegated to the president. There is no institution, even the constitution, is not above the people. All of these arrangements are made for the welfare of the people of Mali. If the president abuses the constitution, if the president is the first one to violate all of the rules and laws that he has himself promulgated, if he's the one that does not respect the constitution, you do not expect others to follow suit. He is the guarantor of the constitution of Mali. He has been invested in that power. First of all, the president changing the will of the people. When we voted for our parliament, he, through the constitutional court, totally changed. And that alone is a violation of the constitution that can trigger the determination of his power. So we are living in abuse of power, but also he's not keeping his promises of security. He's not keeping his promise of fighting corruption. And Mali has never been this corrupt since independence. So we want the welfare of the people. This is not a movement. It's not a political party. It's not a political opposition. It is a movement of the people of Mali suffering from the ill governance of this regime. And that's why it is legitimate, it's constitutional right, correct, that we request that he steps down.
Will your group still maintain he steps down in spite of an expected recommendation from regional leaders who will be holding a meeting, an extraordinary summit on Monday?
Well, the meeting will be held on the premise that the people of Mali have requested the resignation of their president. And they have come, they listened, they've listened all the parties, and they've understood that, one, Mali has been led by a shadow government for so long because this president is more or less incapacitated because of illness and his old age, and he's not able to make the right decision for the people. So we think that his family and cronies are the one leading the country, and that is unconstitutional. But the reality is Ibeka is no longer capable, he's no longer fit to lead the people of Mali, and he has proven this by failure to move Mali forward at any level of governance. None of his policies have succeeded, whether it is security, whether it is education, whether it is economy, health. There is absolutely no success area for 7 years of absolute power by his family. So we believe that it is time that we don't continue to make considerations that will hold the people of Mali back. We need to go forward, and we need to seize this moment to make the right decision, but also tough decision for the welfare of the people of Mali.
Yeye Samake is a leading member of the Malian opposition coalition N5 and a former opposition presidential candidate. He spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. In Nigeria, a presidential spokesperson has rejected demands by the country's opposition party for President Muhammadu Buhari to step down. The People's Democratic Party, or the PDP, says the president has failed to keep his promise to weed out endemic corruption. It says despite repeated promises, there's a sharp rise in public corruption across the country. The party also accused the president of failing his core constitutional duty to protect life and property. This following reports of a surge in kidnappings and attacks carried out by militant groups including Boko Haram in some parts of the country. But supporters of the administration reject the accusations. They say the latest criticisms are part of an effort to score cheap political points. Shehu Garba, a spokesperson for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, tells me that the president keeps demonstrating his commitment to combating corruption and will not be deterred or distracted by the opposition party's accusations.
The PDP suffered a stunning defeat barely a year ago in a general election that was won by President Muhammadu Buhari. After they lost in that election, they went to the court, they lost in court, they appealed to the Supreme Court of Nigeria, they still lost there. So if they are Democrats, unless they are working against democracy in our country, shouldn't they wait until the next election? Because in a democracy, periodic elections determine the life, the state of government. You can't go into election, lose, and then say that the government elected by the children's bank. But beyond that, what did they say was their reason? They said because new cases of corruption have arisen even under President Muhammad Buhari. We were saying to them, so what? Because the fact that President Buhari is fighting corruption does not in any way limit him to corruption that had occurred in the past. If cases of corruption arise now, it is not a shame, it is not a scandal for President Muhammad Buhari to open it up and investigate. This is the difference Buhari makes. You can't cover these things up, because if you don't investigate, because you don't want to be shamed that this is action, this have taken place under your own administration, then you're covering up. That would be a betrayal of historical proportion. President Buhari will not cover up.
The PDP is concerned and says that there seemed to be a sharp rise in cases of corruption, and that the president promised to weed out corruption in Nigeria seemed to be just a promise yet to be kept, and that the president has not been effective. The institutions of governance to clamp down on corruption have not been strengthened to fight the menace. What do you say to that?
In their own case, they took power and held it for 15 years. Major corruption cases under them, they took to them in the cooler until President Muhammadu Buhari came. So President Muhammadu Buhari will deal with historical cases he inherited, will deal with cases that arise under his administration. Corruption in Nigeria is endemic. It's not going to go away with a wave of the hand. It will take a lot of doing, including attitudinal change in the country, and we are achieving this. Before President Muhammad Buhari, before this time, many Nigerians did not even think there was anything wrong with corruption. They thought it was normative, okay for government business. We have made progress. At least Nigerians now accept majorly that corruption is wrong and they should not be entertained.
So, Garbashe, how would you rate the fight against corruption as promised to Nigerians by the president?
It is doing so well. It gets to the point where even the watchman on the hill is himself being investigated for suspected wrongdoing. It says that there are no sacred cows in the fight against corruption under President Buhari.
Well, Garba, some people are saying that it seems as if President AFCC Interim Chairman Magu's fight against corruption, as mandated by the president for him to do, corruption is fighting him back. And that is why the allegations are being made against him that he himself has participated in wrongdoing. How is the presidency looking at this allegations or investigation against Chairman Magu?
First of all, it would say that the anti-corruption war of the Buhari administration is not held around only one person or one institution. The police are involved, the Auditor General, the Federation is involved, the Secret Service is involved, the Ministry of Finance is doing it, the Ministry of Justice is doing it. So there is a problem with one arm of the government investigating or dealing with the corruption. That is not to say that other arms are equally crooked. Whether Magu is guilty or not is not for me to say. It is the outcome of the investigation that is ongoing now.
Garba, before you go, what would you say to Nigerians with regards to the president's commitment and promise to fight corruption in Nigeria?
There's no going back. The president is fully committed. He's already being proclaimed as the champion of anti-corruption in West Africa, in the entire continent of Africa. He will not fail Nigerians. He will not fail Africa.
Shehu Garba is a spokesperson for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, the Coalition for Good Governance, a political pressure group, has welcomed as a positive development demand by the Senate that funds paid to officials at the Niger Delta Development Commission, or NDDC, should be returned. A Senate committee is investigating allegations of corruption at the Niger Delta Development Commission. According to the Senate, its preliminary inquiry alleges financial malfeasance at the NDDC. Among the recommendations from the Senate committee is for funds unjustifiably paid to the interim management of the NDDC to be returned. This after the investigation showed millions of dollars were recklessly spent without due process. Jefferson Oriagore, chairman and convener of the Coalition for Good Governance in Delta State, says the perpetrators of corruption at the NDDC should face the full force of the law. He tells me that revelations of act of corruption at the NDDC show a gross abuse of power and the disregard for established procedures aimed at protecting the public purse.
think the Senate Ad Hoc Committee have done the right thing. The NDDC was actually set up to carry out development. And as a policy document for NDDC, they find out that most of the money the IMC spent were not actually meant for the purpose at which the money was budgeted. And as such, for instance, telling the IMC to refund all the money paid to staff, we support it because in the first place, if it's not supported from the policy point of view that such money should be given to staff and such money were appropriated to staff, it becomes fraudulent. And as such, if it becomes fraudulent, they are supposed to refund the money to the commission for appropriation for projects to be executed. These funds are meant to execute projects for the development of Niger Delta region. And we find out that there are a lot of diversion. Now, if the Senate Ad Hoc Committee find out after their investigation that these funds we are talking about were not properly managed, and they have asked the IMC to refund the money, I think the good governance supports such a move.
Some people are suggesting that telling them to refund the money might not necessarily serve as a deterrent in the fight against corruption, and that they should also be prosecuted in this case. What is the stance of your organization?
In the course of this investigation and the course of this development, it is expected that they have found one thing. And I think a severe punishment should be given to those corporates to serve as a deterrent to others who might in future be appointed to also manage the affair of NDDC. I am in support of that. They have to give them their punishment according to the law of the nation. That is our stand.
Now, Jefferson, the panel also recommended that henceforth or moving forward, the NDDC should report directly to President Muhammadu Buhari and ask that the president dissolves the IMC or the Interim Management Committee and set up a board for the commission. What is your reaction to that?
There people are always suggesting the way forward. I think if the NDDC Act has to be repealed or have to be amended, you can only get that suggestion, can only get result for that suggestion when the NDC Act is amended. I believe people have their opinion to whatever that is happening. A lot of persons are saying the NDC should report it to the president. But I also put it to you that may not also solve the problem we are having today. Take, for instance, what we are seeing in APC-led government today. There are a lot of issues also emanating from the presidency. So when you also look at it from that perspective, it is not also a solution. But these things have to be documented, have to be gazetted. In the sort that the NDCC Act have to be amended and call for the public hearing of every individual to bring in their inputs for final decision to be passed to law. That will serve better. But I'm not also in support of the NDC reporting to the presidency.
Why? Because some people are suggesting that reporting directly to the president will ensure that a spotlight is placed on the NDDC to ensure this recurring allegations of corruption do not crop up again.
Do you think reporting to the president will solve the issue? Are there no issues with NMPC? NMPC is at the report directly to the president. Are there no also issues? So what I think is the standardization of the country, and also what I also suggest to be done is that a separate entity, or let me say someone, a technocrat, should be appointed to manage this NDDC instead of this politician. Just imagine you are bringing a professor because of political interest to manage a commission of such nature. It calls for concern. So to me, reporting to presidency may not also 100% solve the problem. It's a system issue, and that the system has to find a way to deal with it. That is our position. There are a lot of technocrats, there are a lot of experts who can handle positions, who can handle such organizations. The president should look for such, coupled with the NC policy and act, and I believe things will go well, smoothly.
Jefferson Oriagorie is the chairman and convener of the Coalition for Good Governance in Nigeria's Delta State. He spoke with me from the capital, Asaba. Lesotho's information minister says the government has stepped up efforts in the fight to limit the spread of the coronavirus. Tesele Maseribani says the administration in Maseru is working with neighboring South Africa in a bilateral initiative to help to curb the spread of the disease. His remark comes after the local media say infected persons might have entered the country from neighboring countries, including South Africa. Officials have confirmed 359 cases with 6 deaths and 69 have recovered. Information Minister Tesele Maseribani tells me that his administration is committed to halting the spread of the disease.
In Lesotho, it's about 2 million in that. But most of the Basotho, they work in South African labor migrants or domestic workers, and also at farmers, or at aids for farming in the farmers of South Africa. We also have a high-level diaspora, which is also seeking jobs in South Africa. So the issue is, you know, South Africa is one of the high-risk countries. But now, with the influx of people coming from South Africa to Lesotho, we have moved from a stage of having infection from being exported from other countries to Lesotho. The 7,432 is the number of total cases. Out of 7,432, we have 359 positive patients, with only 69 total recovers and only 6 fatalities. Now, in terms of districts, as you know, that with Lesotho has 10 districts, the most affected district is Maseru at 51.6%, and Butabute, which is along the side of South Africa, it has 11.7%. Tabateka is inside Lesotho at the highlands of Lesotho. There is no infection, and that's an area where at the moment we are making research why we don't have COVID-19 at that high altitude level. There are some unallocated cases, which is 1 to 0.4. So in terms of saying which stage we are, Lesotho is at level orange, which is level 4. That says one patient can infect 2 or more people, as far as R0 formula, putting the lives of many at risk. The King's message was that we need also to change our culture. Burials, we must also find how best we can have short, and people must be buried in the morning, short burials because of social distancing, because of not putting people together at one place for a long time.
Has your government's policy to limit the spread of the coronavirus in the kingdom been effective so far?
Well, we're still busy with fighting on testing. We need to have a mass testing program. Where our labs, there is a national university laboratory. There are about few private laboratories that we want to engage so that people can have access, even also to have mobile testing, so that we can be able to fight the economy while fighting the coronavirus. Because you know we're an LDC country. So in terms of having case management, yes, we have 2 hospitals, one in the south and one in the north, where we have identified those hospitals as coronavirus hospitals. It's in an area called TY. The other one is in an area called Masete.
Do you have the infrastructure to handle the caseload of infection? Because as you rightly noted, you are next to South Africa, which is having difficulty in controlling the disease.
Well, in terms of controlling diseases, I think there's a lot of training that has to be done to our doctors. We're having some few challenges of risk handling. Our doctors and nurses are really saying, look, we're in the front line. We need to be sure about that we are covered. Our risk allowances, an issue of PPE, it has been an issue in the country, that we need to have proper PPEs. We also need to engage all local structures, which is the chiefs, the priests, even the private sector. Schools are still closed in Lesotho. The churches are still closed in Lesotho. We are trying to manage and prevention of spreading of disease.
Despite the challenges neighboring South Africa is having, it has the infrastructure and the technical know-how. And the fight against limiting the spread is ongoing in South Africa. Are you having any technical assistance or working closely with the government in South Africa to have some help to limit the spread of coronavirus in the Kingdom of Lesotho?
I'll say there were some bilateral discussions at high level where the President and the Prime Minister met to discuss about the support, where we're trying to facilitate support from the African Union, but not specially from South Africa. But we are in the bilateral agreement that we need to help each other to fight the spread of COVID-19.
So what is the next step forward? Because in some countries, they are calling for schools to be opened and all that. Do you think Lesotho is at a stage where it will say, okay, for the next step forward, we are going to allow schools to open? Or you think the situation is still dangerous to allow schools to reopen?
At the moment, we are still challenged with the issue of trying to find a solution to allow schools to open. It is not possible for us to take that risk at the moment while the infection rate is sometimes it spikes in a day. You get about 10 cases in a day. And remember, those results are not based on the actual time. It is the swabs that has been, you know, maybe 2 days backward. Then we get results after 3 days. So there's still a gap of saying, are the numbers accurate or are we depending on those numbers? Because we don't have a system that is online. When you test, you get your results. You have to wait online. You have to wait and wait up until they finish the other swabs that they have collected. Then they issue out the results of those swabs because of limited infrastructure.
Sele Masribani is the Lesotho Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. But first, mayors of some African cities have launched a recovery plan to address the impact of the coronavirus. The C40 Mayor's Agenda for a Green and Just Recovery is an agenda that outlines practical steps aimed at delivering an equitable and sustainable recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic and to end fossil fuel subsidies. The outcome of the plan seeks to create a new normal, which will identify, contain, and proactively prepare cities for future pandemics while addressing systematic injustices. Officials say the agenda also includes measures currently underway in cities including Nairobi, Freetown, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, Addis Ababa, Lagos, and Accra. To learn more about the C40 Mayor's Agenda for a Green and Just Recovery, I reach Hastings Chikoko, Regional Director for Africa, C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group.
C40 Mayor's established a Mayor Recovery Task Force, which actually included 11 mayors that actually came together to define how cities, how mayors can respond to COVID, but also look into the future in terms of how cities can recover. This is really recognizing that cities are really the epicenter of this pandemic, and mayors are in the forefront of dealing with this pandemic. So this is an agenda, a broad agenda taken by mayors, and really a solid commitment to build back better. I think what they are saying is we want to build green economy going forward, a resilient future, ensure that there is jobs and inclusion, but also ensure that we improve mobility.
Now, Hastings, what are the expected outcomes regarding this ambitious plan?
First of all, I think the mayors would like to influence green economic stimulus. So there will be really engagement with national government to ensure that when we bail out businesses or whatever they do to invest back, they should focus on green investment. So we are expecting, in terms of outcomes, we're expecting really green investments in transport, energy, industry, and all aspects that are high carbon emitting areas to really follow a low carbon trajectory. Another outcome is to ensure that we safeguard cities and indeed countries from future pandemic and emergencies. So investing in the public service, the health sector, ensuring that there is water and sanitation facilities. If you recall, COVID-19 to some extent caught us unaware and exposed the weaknesses of some of our sectors. So the main outcome from this agenda is to ensure that future pandemics do not create the havoc that COVID-19 did. We are better prepared for future pandemics.
There are concerns that this pandemic has exposed what some people have described as inequalities in cities and across cities in different regions of the world, while it disproportionately impacts Black people. But then how do these mayors with this plan intend to address this now, during and after the pandemic, and in future pandemics?
I think the first thing at the moment is to focus on emergency relief to disadvantaged communities, really getting there and understanding the needs. And already mayors are doing that. African mayors are already in informal settlements
trying to really look at the food needs and giving food parcels because people are not able to now earn income for themselves. Getting testing facilities, these protective measures to those communities. Going forward, I think it's about ensuring that what we do, we embrace the spirit of inclusion. We don't leave anyone behind. So we work with different organized groups, whether it's civil society organizations, whether it's the urban movement, to make sure that the needs of each and every settlement in a city are taken into account, to make sure that they come to the planning table, to make sure that the programmers have really considered the needs of those areas.
In your earlier submission, you spoke about the need to invest in green energy, among others. But some people are saying that it's not pragmatic since high carbon and fossil fuel intensive industries are thriving, which they said is an engine growth to most economies at the moment. And that some Western countries did this and got them to where they are now. Telling new or upcoming or third world cities to do the same or not do the same, but go to green energy, they said it's not feasible. What do you say to skeptics like that?
Countries can pursue a low carbon growth path, but at the same time achieve their economic development goals. So this whole notion of if we go green, then we can't go our economies is a facade. It's false. I think the main point is problems that we are having now because of those that developed before us did not follow the appropriate or the right growth pathways. It would be unfortunate for regions that are developing to repeat the mistake of the past. I think the best is to learn from the past and look for models that can achieve both outcomes. And those models are not in short supply. There are so many examples. When you even look at some countries like Denmark, they are demonstrating that a green economy is possible. A green economy does not mean that you focus on saving the planet at the expense of economic growth.
Hastings Chikoko is the Regional Director for Africa C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Zimbabwean money transfer platform EcoCash is fighting a search and seizure warrant that the country's police obtained against it from the High Court. The move is the latest in a series of run-ins with regulatory authorities for the company in recent months. For VOA, Adi Gondo has more from Bulawayo.
Econet, the parent company of EcoCash, this week filed an appeal to the High Court of Zimbabwe for a stay of execution against the Zimbabwe Republic Police ZRP warrant. The warrant would allow police to search the company's offices for documents or information regarding Econet Wireless. The Police Criminal Investigation Department Asset Forfeiture Unit is investigating the parent company of the Wireless Telecommunications Unit over allegations of currency manipulation, money laundering violations, and of fueling parallel market currency dealings. The police allege that over the first 6 months of the year, Econet Wireless and its subsidiaries created fake subscribers, merchant bills and agents, crediting them huge amounts of money to be distributed through trust accounts. The digital money would then be used to buy foreign currency on the parallel market. EcoCash subsidiary is the largest provider of electronic money services in the cash-strapped country. In its appeal, the company says the warrant infringes its rights and the rights of its subscribers. The Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA, and the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights have joined the appeal through their own separate appeals. MISA Executive Director Tabani Moyo says Econet has almost 12 million subscribers and the vague details of the warrant could lead to infringements of their rights.
If the police have got an intention to search and seize, must be clearly defined parameters of where they want to go rather than to seize the whole database of a company that is 98% in terms of market share for mobile money and almost 80% of telecoms use in terms of market share around voice and other services.
He says the country's constitution ensures the right to privacy and that subscribers entrusted EcoCash with their private data and not the police. The Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights concurs. Blessing Nyamaropa is the head of litigation for the organization.
We feel that the warrant of seizure is so wide in ambit is so vague that even the privacy of our client will be affected by it, yet our client has nothing to do with the reason why the seizure want to be done.
The government has alleged that mobile money transfers are allowing illegal money laundering and illicit foreign currency trading, which have contributed to the collapsing value of the Zimbabwe RTGS currency. Zimbabwe's economy has been crippled by soaring inflation, shortages of critical imports such as fuel, medicines and some foods, a drought, and now the coronavirus pandemic. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In athletics, a former world 1500 meters champion, Elijah Manangoi, has been provisionally suspended over an alleged whereabouts failure. The 27-year-old Kenyan won gold at the 2017 World Championships in London. He also won a silver in Beijing 2 years earlier. Manangoi is one of four Kenyan athletes who the Athletics Integrity Unit, AIU, announced on Thursday had been suspended or provisionally suspended pending a full hearing. Under anti-doping regulations, athletes have to inform testing authorities of their whereabouts for a one-hour window of every day. Three failures in 12 months, not being present at the said time or filing inaccurate or incomplete information, counts as one failure and leads to an automatic ban. Patrick Seile was also provisionally suspended for allegedly evading, refusing or failing to submit for a sample collection. Seile is a long-distance athlete. Marcel Kibarus was banned for 8 years after testing positive for an anabolic steroid, a second doping offense within a 10-year time frame. And Kenneth Kipkemoi was also suspended for 2 years after testing positive for tabline. In boxing, former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson will return to the boxing ring for an exhibition fight against ex-4-weight world champion Roy Jones Jr. The fight is scheduled to take place on September 12th in Los Angeles. 54-year-old Tyson last fought professionally in 2005 when he was beaten by Irishman Kevin McBride in what was his sixth loss in 58 career fights. Fellow American Jones, who is 51, has not fought since beating Scott Sigmund in February of 2018. The fight will be 8 rounds and will be broadcast on pay-per-view. Tyson became the youngest ever world heavyweight champion at age 20 when he knocked out Trevor Burbick in 1986. Jones Jr., during his career, claimed world titles at middleweight, super middleweight, light heavyweight, and heavyweight. And in African football, Sierra Leone top flight has been cancelled due to COVID-19. The decision to annul the 2019-2020 football season was unanimously taken by the Premier League board in consultation with the Sierra Leone Football Association at a meeting held on July 15th in Freetown. The meeting resolved to cancel the entire season with no champions declared and with the same teams for next season. Finally, the Confederation of African Football Disciplinary Board met last week to discuss incidents from the CAF Champions League 2019-2020 quarterfinal second leg between TP Mazembe of DR Congo and Raja Club Athletic of Morocco held in March in Lubumbashi. The board decided to impose a fine of $10,000 on Raja Club for unfortunate behavior of their players, which resulted in the incitement of the TP Mazembe spectators. The board lifted the provisional suspension on Ilyas Haddad, but cautioned him for his unsporting behavior. It also imposed a fine of $10,000 on TP Mazembe for security failure during the match in question. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
zaga niambie tuakomeshe tuakomeshe vishada wavimbe wateseke we nipende tu nipe na nyota tembele wacha wibiga kuna baby tushikane twakime we ni doctor mimgojwa ndomana mkona mweza koni na pona umenija akili ni ndomana kutanja mweza koni na ngoma.
Yeah. don't know how much you mean to me. That sucks, sucks, sucks. Because no one can take you. No one, no one. I don't want to be a farmer. I don't want another man to come and take her. Yeah.
that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you do not teach the paths of the forest to an old gorilla. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.